So yeah, this is a nice breezy intro for another episode of Does It Matter?
I'm Alex. That's Ben.
Here we are with probably one of our weirdest episodes so far. I'm gonna guess.
Yeah, we're stretching the formula a little bit on this one.
Yeah, this came up from a conversation we had last episode. We're talking this time about things that you got too late.
Whatever that may mean.
Right.
how's it going this week?
You know, I had one immediate example because it's such an extreme case.
Alright.
Which I guess I'll jump right in with.
Let's do it.
So here's a story. When I was 7 years old, back in 1997, I heard this song while a babysitter was sitting for me and my brother and sister. She came in, she put MTV on, and there was this music video, and all I remember is it had these like blue and red flashing lights sort of pulsing across the screen, and it was this song where like it had this lilting female voice, and then it would like stop and it would instead do this kind of like punk rocky sound, and I didn't even know what punk rock was at the time. And it just kept on going back and forth between all these three different melodies, and I was just sitting there going like, oh my god, I didn't know music could be like this. I didn't know it could be so all over the place. This is amazing. And I remember asking the babysitter, her name was Corinne, I was like, Corinne, what is this? And she goes, I don't know. And I was crushed. Because, I mean, this was 1997, there was no like looking up what a song is in any way if you don't already know what the song is.
Yeah, I'm sitting here thinking, okay, female vocals, multiple melody lines, flashing lights, what could that be?
Right. So she goes, I think the name of the...
Sorry. A little ripped up today.
She goes, I think the name of the band is Bananarama. And I was like, alright, I guess my favorite band is Bananarama, because I had decided in this moment, this is my favorite song. So I didn't hear this song again until I was in college. I was like a sophomore in college, I'm hanging out with my friend Nick, and he starts playing it, and like I just light up. I'm like, oh my god, I know this song. This was my favorite song from like 15, 20 years ago. This is amazing. And he goes, no, it's the only good song they ever made. Like, I only have this one album, and I only listen to one song. And I was so shamed by it. I was like, oh, here's my good friend telling me, like, it's not worth getting into. But I wrote down the name of the band, I took it home, and I downloaded their album. And, again, like, because there was this shame associated with it, I just didn't touch it for, like, another handful of years. Up until, in fact, like, 3 weeks ago. And I went, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to listen to this album and see if I like it. For my own self.
All right.
And that's how I found out that I really like Chumbawamba.
Oh, boy.
So.
Boy, sorry, just needed a minute. It's a surprisingly good song.
Okay, and so you immediately know that I'm talking about Tub Thumper.
Yes, sir.
Or is it Tub Thumping? I think the name of the song is Tub Thumping, the name of the band is Tub... the name of the album is Tub Thumper.
Yeah, something like that. I never had it. It was, you know, I was aware of it, but...
Right, and the fun thing about this is, like, I, in the last 3 weeks, have listened to all 18 of the albums.
Yeah, they have a lot.
They have a very broad career.
Like, I remember, like, when they came out, like, hearing, like, yeah, they're this, like, kind of punk rock band that just, like, all of a sudden broke big.
Yeah.
And for some reason.
So, I have listened to all of their albums in the last 3 weeks, and I learned a lot of really interesting things about them, and I want to share some of them with you guys now. So, like I said, 18 albums released over the span of 25 years. That ranges from, like, atmospheric experimental songs to sort of, like, punky hard rock songs to more experimental putting those two styles together. They're definitely weird, especially in their earlier days. One of their songs, the drum beat is hi-hat, hi-hat, dog bark, rest. So, the entire song is underscored by chick-chick-woof, chick-chick-woof. So there's that. Several of their albums, in between songs, there's just clips of, like, TV shows playing. The Simpsons feature very prominently in one of their albums.
Which album?
A couple of them. That one is Anarchy. And Anarchy is actually a really intriguing album. The whole thing sort of is the crux of their political work, although they have political songs throughout almost all of their albums. Anarchy's first song starts with just a vocal refrain, just a chant of "Nothing burns down by itself. Every fire needs a little bit of help." They've got, like, this really rambunctious spree to them. I like to think of what they have done as falling into three distinct periods. The first period, they had this sort of, like, one song would be, like, an atmospheric song with the female lead singer, and then the next song would be, like, a sort of punky hard rock song with the male lead singer. And they would sing about sort of similar things sometimes, and sometimes not so much. They definitely have a good balance for a band that has these sort of two lead singer presences in it. And that sort of defines their first third. Their middle third, I would define as being kind of a cross between Cake and Momus. And that's a comparison that doesn't mean a lot to many people. But if you know what it means and you listen to Chumbawamba, you'll be like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, like, it makes sense.
And then the last third of their career is getting back a lot to what they did. They did one album back in their first third of their career called English Rebel Songs, 1381 to 1914.
Oh, dear.
And the whole thing is basically a cappella traditional English folk music.
That sounds awesome.
With a focus on songs that are about rebellion. That album got re-released later in their career, after they had made Tum Thumping, as English Rebel Songs 1381 to 1984. But it's completely the same album. A lot of the stuff in that last third of their career has that same like folk music bent to it. So they really are just all over the place, and in the course of their 25 years, Wikipedia names 11 members of the band as being, like, solid, consistent members of the band. 8 of those members are credited with doing vocals on albums. Everybody really contributes in different ways. They had an accordion player for the last half of the band being together, which really contributed to that folk sound later on. And I have to say, it's been fascinating talking to people about Chumbawamba, because when you mention Chumbawamba, the immediate response is, oh, I get knocked down and I get up again? Mm. And yes, that is Chumbawamba, but Chumbawamba is so many big, confusing, contradictory things. And I'm glad that I found it at this point in my life, because I feel like if I found it when I was younger, I wouldn't have been able to appreciate or analyze it in the way that I have been now.
That makes sense.
But it's it's difficult to describe the experience of, like, getting to know this band. Because they are so broad.
They sound like a difficult band to know well. And, like, the only thing that I know about them outside of the song itself is that, like, it was used in a car commercial at some point. And the reason that they agreed to do that is so that they could then donate the proceeds from selling their song to a car commercial to, like, anti-automobile lobbying groups and, you know, environmental stuff. And I wish I had some kind of source for that, because it's not a very specific memory, but I remember reading that somewhere and being like, these guys seem all right. But I've heard that song a lot.
Yeah, that sounds like the most them thing that I can really imagine. They're well known in the UK as being voices of contrarian everything when it comes to the government. Their first two albums have some of my favorite album titles of their careers. The first one being Pictures of Starving Children Sell Records. And the second one being Never Mind the Ballots. Their second most recent album is entitled The Boy Bands Have Won. they have fun with that.
I'm definitely going to have to listen to some of those. You going to go back out? Okay, kid's going back out. Maybe.
We're recording this in my room, the door of which does not have a latch that actually prevents cats from pushing the door open completely. So we are
visitors.
Yeah, we are regularly joined by George, the Siamese cat.
He's so soft. I miss cats in my life. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's tub thumping. It took 21 years for me to actually come back. To this, I was really late on the draw, but
I'm about to say something that sounds really anachronistic, but I'm gonna go home and maybe listen to some Chumbawamba. Okay, so speaking of anachronistic, thinking about this subject, I was like, all right, what are different ways I can approach this? I like came too late, and the first thing that I thought of was like. Maybe kind of the inverse of the most obvious meaning, but it's like something that I came to too late in my life. Something that I am too old for. And when I think of that, one particular example pops up in my head, and he lives in a pineapple under the sea. So I'm pretty sure everyone who might even possibly be thinking about listening to this knows what I'm talking about. But just in case you don't, it's SpongeBob SquarePants, which is, like, the highest-rated show Nickelodeon has ever produced. I think it recently started its 11th season. There's, like, 229 episodes. Yeah, I have on my notes here, like, list of stats. 229 episodes. Two movies. One of money. Okay. And I think I was trying to, like, put a finger and like a pin on like what about this is like what's the deal, because there's a lot of really creative, interesting, talented people involved in this. Like the humor is like really bizarrely absurdist in a way that seems like it would kind of be my jam, and I came up with a theory. And to kind of elaborate on that, I'm going to start out by saying that SpongeBob was created by a guy named Steven Hillenburg, who I did a little research on. He's an interesting dude. He was like an oceanography or a marine biology professor or something for a while, and then was like, nah, screw it, I'm going to like animation school. And did that, and produced a couple of short films, at least one of which is on YouTube called The Green Beret. I watched it, it's trippy as hell. There's another one called Wormholes, and these were like made as student animation films. And based on these and, like, probably some other work, I don't really know the whole story. I'm sourcing this from Wikipedia, so, you know.
Sure.
But based on that, he got a job as a director on Rocko's Modern Life, which was another Nicktoon.
Also fairly absurdist.
Also, yeah, well, I'm going to get there. he was a director for, like, Rocko's Modern Life ran from 93 to 96. And he was, like, a director of a bunch of episodes for, like, 93 and 94, and then kind of became, like, the creative director showrunner for the second half of the series. When Rocko, which was created by a dude named Joel Murray, by the way, got canceled, like, a lot of the creative staff that was working on that grouped for this thing that Hillenburg had been working on, based on, like, an educational comic he used when he was a professor about life in the ocean. like kind of expanding on that, and like that team became like the SpongeBob team. So it's like a lot of the same people involved, and they are in many ways very similar, both like in terms of the overall structure, like main character who is like male, sort of young adultish, has a small pet that doesn't talk but is still a big part of the show, lives alone, lives next door to someone who's really like older and grumpy and like always up in his business, has a really big like kind of dumb best friend, and they do everything together, and then they have kind of a weird third friend also, works like a menial job. All of these things are true of both shows. They also have like the same kind of weird absurdist humor. They have this like very, what I wrote down is like psychedelic tinged art style. Mm-hmm. Like I'm thinking of those like sea backgrounds on SpongeBob that are like the kind of 60s patterns. And like Rocco's styling is like a little bit more, I don't know, art deco-y almost.
Yeah.
Very pop art inspired is what I wrote down. So like these two things are related, and I think part of the reason that I have the negative reaction to SpongeBob that I have is because I fell in love with Rocko's Modern Life first, and so to me that's like, this is the pure vision of this. Like I actually found myself googling how old is SpongeBob SquarePants, and I had this moment where I was like, what am I doing with my life? But SpongeBob has like no specific age, whereas Rocko does. He's I think 21. I don't know, they mention it at some point in the series, but it's also like Rocko's Modern Life is the only Nicktoon I can think of that has an adult main character.
This is true,
which I found interesting. The episode topics, like, I don't know if this is actually true. This is the impression that I have in my head, so I want to preface that. Like, the impression that I have in my head of Rocko's episode topics is that they are very, like, more fundamentally about mundane situations than SpongeBob's are. Like, I haven't seen that many episodes of SpongeBob, but I remember one where, like, he opens, like, a bubble-blowing stand or something for some reason. Whereas, like, I remember a Rocko episode where he has to go to the DMV.
Yeah.
There's one where vacuum cleaner. And then it tries to kill him, but, you know.
The episode of Rocko's Modern Life that I always remember is the one where his neighbor Filbert, or friend Filbert... Mm,
the turtle.
He opens a fortune cookie, and it has a bad fortune, mm-hmm. and he becomes obsessed with opening all of the fortune cookies to find a good fortune, but they all have the same bad fortune for him.
I remember that one.
It's like the most mundane thing that you could possibly happen to somebody. Like, you get a bad fortune cookie fortune.
One of, just, like, because I just thought of it, like, one of my favorite bits from a Rocko episode ever is, like, one where his car gets impounded. And so, like, he has to deal with, like, getting to work and stuff like that without a car. And so he gets in a cab, and the cab driver's talking, and he's like, my son, now, he's always a-bugging me. He's always, Dad, give me money. Dad, give me money. Dad, give me money. You look like you have money. And then Rocco's like, yeah, I was wondering how far $10 would get me. And, like, the cab just, like, backs up. And, I don't know, that always made me laugh, because it reminded me of my dad. But anyway, the overall tone of Rocko, I think, is a little bit, like, more anxious and sad than SpongeBob's is, and, like, that resonates with me a little bit. And I think part of this is also, like, SpongeBob premiered in 1999. I was 14. Or I turned 14 in 1999, so, like, there's also that element of, like, this is for babies. I'm a teenager now, I'm over this. But I still love this thing that I saw when I was 8. kind of the combination of those reasons, I developed this sort of aversion to it, even though I know it's probably good. And I think that's kind of part of what we're talking about here when it's talking about, like, came too late for. It's about the relationship you have with something based on time. So that's what I have with that.
As a kid who wasn't allowed to watch TV until SpongeBob had come out, I have almost the opposite, where, like, I love Rocco when I see it, but I never got, like, immersed in it enough to be like, oh, I participate with this show. Like, I understand.
Yeah.
Like, I've just seen maybe, like, 6 episodes scattered across my youth, where SpongeBob was the thing that, like, my mom got into. She's like, oh my god, let's watch the bubble episode again. Like, oh my gosh, look, SpongeBob has bad breath for a whole episode. That's so funny.
Isn't there one where he, like, rips his pants all the time or something?
Yeah, it's, like, the second episode of the show.
Yeah.
It's like, one of the foundational things that set up. Like, SpongeBob wants to be liked, and ripping his pants makes him liked. And he has to learn, don't rip your pants all the time.
I guess that's a valuable lesson.
Yeah, I mean, like, as a metaphor, it's kind of sweet.
Mm.
It's just, SpongeBob is so wildly all over the place. Like, they've done, like, horror episodes. They've done, like, diabolical, like, Plankton is gonna shut down the place where SpongeBob works plots. But then there's also just, like, my friend is mad at me and I have to cheer them up. Or, like, I have to sell chocolate bars door to door. It's an odd show. SpongeBob is constantly being duped. And that's kind of what endeared me to the show.
He seems like a very interestingly naive character.
Yeah, like, he's just, he's so pure and such a rube that, like, the show, like, it...
That's a great description.
It preys on him, and that's part of the thrill of the show, is watching it and being like, is, like, he's gonna be okay, obviously, but, like, I need to watch him fall into, like, some negative way of thinking or being, and then, like, come back out. It's very, like, children's showy in that way.
Mm.
But it's adult enough in the way it presents it that, like, I can watch it and be like, yeah, this is fine. I don't seek it out, but it's fine. I loved it when I was a kid. Let's see, speaking of things that you got too late to enjoy,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to talk about something that's... I know I'm not alone on this, but throughout my life, this has been a very isolating thing. I don't like Star Wars any...
That's... an easier perspective to understand now than it was when I loved it.
See, my hypothesis here is that a lot of the reason that I struggle with Star Wars is that I got to it too late.
Mm.
So, especially for people in, like, my generation, I think, we had... Let me talk about Star Wars a little bit, and then I'll talk about my experience with it.
Okay.
So there's, thus far, 3 trilogies, so to speak. There was the original one, which was made from released 1977 to 1983. Then, between 1999 and 2005, we got the prequel trilogy. And then,
I remember that.
2015 to now, we've been getting the new trilogy, the sequels, but more of them.
Yeah.
And all of that is yet to be seen.
It's Disney now, so you know they're gonna milk that dry.
Right. When I was a kid in the 90s, there was only the original trilogy. We didn't get young Anakin until 1999. And as a kid in the 90s, like, I wasn't really shown the original trilogy of Star Wars movies. I remember watching each of them once.
Yeah.
And I have these scattered memories of, like, oh, the forests on Endor, and, like, oh, the icy steps of Hoth, and, like, oh, a lightsaber battle inside of a star, some sort of a starship of some sort. Like, the images, but none of the plot was really there for me. I just knew, like, the characters, and I mean, like, let's be very clear here. Star Wars, when you look up on Wikipedia, it refers to an epic space opera media franchise.
Yeah.
And it has to use media franchise because it's video games, and it's toys, and it's like stickers, it's
anything.
Anything that they can slap that shit on, they do, and they pretty much always have.
Yeah,
it's gotten worse in recent years, but
I seem to recall something about like 20th Century Fox or whoever released the original film in 77, like not thinking it would be a big deal and telling Lucasfilm, "Yeah, you can keep the merchandising rights, whatever."
And one of the things that's really central about Star Wars, it's so fundamental to, I think, 99% of people's understanding of media as a whole. Mm-hmm. Like, people refer to scenes from Star Wars in other movies and TV shows so fluidly that it's taken for granted that you are intimately familiar with each scene in the films. Mm-hmm. I was not that kid. I picked up all of these references, all of these key scenes, these characters, through osmosis from the rest of the world. When, like, my friends talked about it, or when I saw it on TV, or when I, you know, or saw references to it on TV, I should say. Mm. Stuff like that. So, when the prequel trilogy came about, my family went and saw each of them in the theaters. And our response to each of them was kind of, "Duh."
That's understandable.
This is, it has the colorful worlds. It has the characters in form, at least.
The prequel trilogy actually has a really great plot. They just buried it under a lot of nonsense.
Right.
That's a gripe, but anyway.
And so I wasn't into it. That those didn't get me into it, and I still wasn't seeing the old movies. When they would come on, I'd be like, "Eh, nah, that's fine."
Yeah, why bother, right?
And then a thing happens to you when you're a teenager. I think this is true for most people. At least it was true for me. If you hold some opinion and you're challenged on that opinion as a teenager, you don't stop and go, "You know what? Maybe you're right." You burrow further into your own opinion.
Doubling down.
So I went from, "I don't know, I haven't really seen Star Wars," to, "Yeah, I don't really like Star Wars." And eventually it was, "I fucking hate Star Wars."
Yeah.
So for much of my formative youth, I was either unaware or right opposed to the Star Wars franchise. So, again, coming to things very late, I saw the original trilogy for the first time about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
For people who are listening to this in the distant future, I saw them in, like, 2017. Exactly 40 years after the first one actually came out. Now, I learned a lot of interesting things, because I had always conceptualized in my head the original trilogy as being a sort of solid unit in the same way that the prequel trilogies are. Those were like kind of all, like, they all have the same writer and director team. It's all George Lucas doing it. And they all sort of share a vision for what the trilogy is about, even though that vision is a little bit misguided at times.
Often.
At many times, we'll say.
About 80% of the time.
And I was very surprised to find that A New Hope is a movie that has a very particular look and feel to it, and Revenge of the Sith, I think, is the fifth one?
Revenge of the Sith...
Or Empire Strikes Back.
Empire's the fifth one. Yeah.
Empire Strikes Back has, like, a completely different... It's much more moody, it's very dark, it kind of has, like, a film noir sense to it.
It has better acting.
Then you get to the third movie, and the third movie's, like, kind of more for kids. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot about it is kind of more for kids. But it is, like, high-flying and whimsical and very colorful. It's much more colorful than any of the other movies are.
It is.
And that was fascinating to me. So now, as like, a legitimate adult, I kind of think that the reason that the trilogies have the status that they have now, The original trilogy was made for adults, but it was also an acceptable set of movies for kids in large part because it was so broad in terms of story and characters. Like, a kid could watch it and be like, oh, there's a hero, there's a bad guy, there's a bunch of stuff happening. Action, but not too intense of action. Stuff like that.
Kind of a Saturday morning cartoon element to it.
Right, and that's why those movies are so enduring with people, because they see them as kids, and they go, oh, this is Star Wars, it's a whole universe, and then there's all the toys and the games and all this stuff. You get drawn into it, it becomes a part of your life. I missed out on that, and so I came to it too late. I don't get that experience. What I instead got was the prequel trilogy, which is ostensibly straight up for kids, and as a second thought, hey, adults also. Especially as you get to, like, episode 3, where there's, like, child murder.
Yeah. It's really funny on the internet somewhere, I don't know, it was like a meme thing, and it was young Anakin being like, hey Padme, why was the 4-year-old Padawan crying? Why? He was having a midlife crisis. Anyway.
I think the prequel trilogy was disappointing to a lot of adults because it wasn't what they were hoping for. And when I say that, what I mean is they felt like the original trilogy was for them. Like, as kids, they watched it and they went, oh my gosh, this is for me. Like, this is something that, like, specifically calls to me. I can do this.
That makes sense.
When they were, like, 30, 40-year-old adults watching the movies come out in 1999, 2005...
Yeah, hell, 17-year-old kids.
It wasn't for them. It wasn't meant for them. And they were mad about that. And, like, I completely understand that. And then, like, kids looking at those movies, like, they still got into it. Maybe not as much as the original ones, but... What they're doing with the new ones, they're both for kids and adults. It's the Disney thing. You make it... very much for both.
For as broad an audience as possible.
But these movies, they're so polished. They have the Disney polish to them. Yeah. They don't have, like, that rough-cut, weird optimism of the original movies.
Well, like, you look at, like, some of the robots, for example, in A New Hope, like, when R2 and C-3PO get, like, kidnapped by the Jawas and they're, like, in the trash pile and whatever. And, like, that looks like a litter box... That's definitely some kind of garbage can.
Right, there was... Like, there's, like, a gorilla, and that's G-U-E, gorilla,
yeah.
sense to the way that they made the original movies. Because it wasn't necessarily a shoestring budget, but they were, like...
And, like, at the same time, the effects were revolutionary.
Right.
Like, you'd never seen anything like that before. It's fascinating, because it exists in those two spaces. Sorry, anyway.
Yeah, no, those movies feel like... they were made by people. And Disney movies never feel like they're made by people. They're very mechanical. They're like, so refined around all the edges. So I really think... Like, I'm not saying that Star Wars is going to cease to be a thing, because it's probably bigger now than it ever has been. But I think once we see a sort of generational change in the people who grew up with the original series, like, primarily and only as the... like, the presence of Star Wars, there's going to be a different way that people start to feel about it, especially as they continue to get pumped out.
Yeah, it's going to burn out unless they stop doing what they're doing.
So, I mean, I'm calling this one maybe a little bit early, but I'm of the opinion I missed the boat for getting into Star Wars as a kid, which is core to stay as an adult. And because... the engine that creates Star Wars has changed so much. There's never going to be a re-entry point for me. So, I literally was too late for Star Wars. I missed that boat. And if you couldn't tell from the way I introduced this, I really don't feel like I'm missing out.
Nah, you're probably fine at this point. Okay. My thing is, like, not quite as large a scale, but sort of similar.
Mm-hmm.
In that, like, it's a movie that a number of people of my generation, including, nay, perhaps especially my girlfriend, are really into, and that, like, I could have grown up with, arguably should have grown up with, but just missed. And that is The Goonies.
Ooh.
So The Goonies, for anybody like either too old or too young to know, was a movie that came out in 1985. It was directed by Richard Donner, who also directed, among other things, The Omen, the Christopher Reeve Superman, Scrooged, and Lethal Weapon. And his company also produced the X-Men films.
I had no idea that he had so many irons in so many different fires.
Yeah, it's an interesting list. So he directed it. It was written by Chris Columbus, who directed Home Alone, Mrs. Doubtfire, and the first two Harry Potter movies, and he also wrote the script for Gremlins, and, you know, did other stuff, but those are, like, some big ones. And then that screenplay was based on a story by Steven Spielberg, who needs no introduction. But, like, I think my favorite introduction to Spielberg is, like, Schindler's List won Best Picture in 1993, and it wasn't even his best movie that year. Anyway,
what would you say is his best movie that year?
Well, Jurassic Park. Like, it's more formally daring and has endured to a greater degree. Like, Schindler's List is a good movie and very polished, but, like, it's not as interesting, like, fucking as the dinosaurs that still look good 25 years later. Anyway, that's a tangent. So, back to The Goonies. It was made by those three people. It stars Sean Astin, Corey Feldman, Martha Plimpton, Josh Brolin, Joe Pantoliano, and some other people, including Short Round from Indiana Jones 2,
mm-hmm.
whose name escapes me at the moment. It's a cult film.
Did you leave out Corey Feldman?
No, I said Corey Feldman.
Okay.
I wouldn't leave out Feldman.
I was like, wait a second. I need to bask in Corey Feldman's name.
Yeah. In that dude. Which is not a pejorative in any way.
No, he's just, he's living the life.
He's living a life.
He's living the life that he wants to live.
Okay.
Sorry, no. Many tangents this episode.
That's fine. That's a good thing.
That's what we're supposed to do.
Right? That's what people are here for. Is it? I don't know. Does it matter?
Does it matter?
Okay, so The Goonies is about a bunch of kids in Astoria, Oregon, whose, like, homes are gonna get destroyed for some reason or something. And then they get chased by some criminals into some tunnels and discover a treasure and everything's all right.
Yeah, I can't think of a better way to put it.
That's what I got. It's a cult film. It's a generational marker for sure, which I have in parentheses Spielberg touch on here, because, like, it's a generational marker in kind of the same way and for the same generation that I would say Jurassic Park is. Like, E.T. is part of that if you're maybe just, like, a little bit older. It's something that he did, and something that, like, is very much feeding back into the culture in the past decade or so, 5 years, whatever, like, Stranger Things, there was a movie, and it just went through my head, Super 8, maybe?
Yeah.
I think that's the one I'm thinking of, that's, like, basically an homage to that kind of style. Which is a topic unto itself. But anyway. Part of the reason that I'm going on so many tangents is because I first saw this movie at age 25 or so, when Kat was like, wait a minute, you've never seen The Goonies? Sit the fuck down. and made me watch it. And the reaction that I had to it, and basically how I still feel about it, is like, yeah, that was cute. The tunnels and stuff are kind of cool. I don't know, National Treasure is more fun. it's cute, but I don't get it. So, like, this is... Okay, I'm just going to read off my note sheet because that seems the easiest way to direct this. Like, It's hard to talk about. Some of the jokes are funny, I guess. It seems a little anticlimactic for the enthusiasm involved, which is part of the fact that it is aimed at children. And so this kind of feeds into, like, what you were talking about, and what is the inverse of what I was talking about with, like, the SpongeBob thing, where it's like, with that, I developed a particular aversion specifically because of the period in my life when I encountered this, versus this, where it's not that I developed an aversion, but I didn't develop a bond.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it's fine, but alright.
Sometimes the not developing a bond is kind of worse than getting an antipathy.
Yeah, because it gets built up so much, and hatred is passion.
Mm-hmm. It's tough with the Goonies because it's such a weird movie that is still incredibly sentimental, but it seems to be sentimental about the concept of being sentimental. Like, it doesn't attach it to anything within the film concretely.
That's kind of true.
Like, I remember seeing it when I was old enough to be scared by it.
Okay.
And then again when I was old enough to be like, I'm too old for this. So I also kind of missed out on, like, the sweet spot for the Goonies. So, like, I appreciate it for being, like, a weird little movie, and
it's... It is a weird movie.
It's like, it's funny, it's sweet, it's very, like I said, sentimental, but... I don't know about you, like, if a movie is sentimental and it's not, like, rooted in something meaningful, then I'm just like, yeah, it's kind of saccharine. Like, I don't...
Like, it's saccharine... But I think it's saccharine with an edge that was still a little fresh at the time.
True.
Like, I'm thinking of the, like, Corey Feldman talking to the maid in Spanish, and here's where we put the cocaine.
Right.
And, like, that kind of thing. So I think, like, that was part of its project. Like, that's what it was doing, and I think that's maybe why it resonates. But that's an intellectualization of it, not anything that I really feel, you know?
Right. Yeah, it's a weird movie.
It's so weird.
Like, the opening shot is basically Corey Feldman making out, like, tongue making out with a painting.
That's right, I forgot about that.
And like, that always struck me as, like, the weirdest way to start about a bunch of kids finding treasure.
I do love, incidentally, and this is, like, not related to the topic necessarily, but I do love that it's such a big deal here in Oregon.
You know, it's filmed very close to here.
Oh, yeah. You know, just about in 2 hours that way. But, like... The jail that the Fratelli brothers break out of is the site of the Oregon Film Museum now in Astoria. Like, it's a thing. They have a festival for it every year. Like, the house is a site that people go to.
Yeah, it's weird. It's very odd, the movie things that become, like... attractions, like the house where the Christmas Story was filmed, like the one, like it's I've been there, and they sell like leg lamps and t-shirts that say like you'll shoot your eye out and stuff.
I think I have one of those t-shirts somewhere.
The funny thing is they shot it in the house in Cleveland. The entire rest of the movie was shot in Canada. And they're still like, no, Cleveland, right here.
Right. Kind of like the thing on Mount Hood and The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
It's like some of the exterior shots were this. That's it. But like people still talk about it.
I mean, you do what you gotta do to link yourself to a Kubrick film.
Yeah, fair enough.
So I guess my last example is kind of more a, like an emotional one. And this is, I got to something late in the sense of this is something I could have used earlier in my life, and I didn't find until later.
Damn, that's a good one. I wish I thought of that.
So, what I want to talk about is this book called Self-Compassion. It is technically a self-help book. Please don't check out. I know that I'm trying to sell you on a self-help book, but hear me out here. Here's the why. I, in year 2012, when everything was supposed to end in disaster, according to the Mayan calendar, blah-blah-blah, everything kind of did end for me in this, like, colossal, disastrous fashion. I got diagnosed with both bipolar and schizophrenia, and as you imagine, life very difficult for a time.
Yes.
I ended up in all manner of, like, therapy and checking in on so many different medications and seeing which ones work and which ones don't. And oh, guess what? They all have side effects, and some of them are actually making things harder. And all of this process, and for the first time in my life at that moment, my mental health was something that I found I had to take seriously. Like, I knew that I had mental health issues before that. I clearly had issues with depression. I knew that I hallucinated. And I definitely had issues, like, with the way that other people see me. But I didn't know how to address them. And it's a scary thing, so I just didn't. So, starting in 2012, I kind of went down that route, saw plenty of therapists, and I made a lot of progress to the point where I could take care of myself, the point where I no longer was, like, making attempts on my life, which was a huge step forward, since that was, like, a regular thing beforehand.
That's a plus.
Like, I got to the point where I was at least able to take care of my mental health on my own. I was still seeking therapy just to continue the work, but it was irregular and not, like, with a pointed effort. I would go in and be like, well, can you help me figure out what I need to work on, as opposed to, this is what I need to work on.
Yeah, which is sometimes a difficult difference to articulate, but a very important one.
Yeah, it definitely makes a difference when you're going into the room and sitting down and trying to figure out what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Having somebody else say, oh, well, it sounds like you're struggling, this is usually a different answer than you come up with on your own. So, fast forward to late 2016, I guess? Mid 2016? I had just gotten out of this terrible housing situation, and when I say terrible, I mean I had to call the cops because one of my roommates was attacking another one of my roommates with a bat, and the roommate with the bat stole, like, a third of the shit that I owned, and also all of our security deposits, last month's rent, and that month's rent, and just skipped town. I was in a little bit of a tight spot. So I ended up moving in with my girlfriend at the time's family, and they were amazing. And then, like, 2-3 months later, she broke up with me. And I had also just been fired from a job because I was late to work because I was calling the roommate for working over my other roommate with a bat. See, it's all connected here.
Yeah.
So I was, for a brief time, both unemployed and without a home. So I was like, you know what, of all of the times to be in therapy, this is a time that I need to be in therapy. So I took up some free therapy at Portland State University here in Portland. That's where Portland State University is. And like midway through working with this therapist, whose name I never got, I thought it had a sh sound, like a Michelle or a Shannon or something. I gave her a thank you card at the end of our time together, and I just didn't put a name on it. Because I handed it right to her, you know, it was like...
Obviously, this is for you.
Anyway.
You.
She, thanks, lady. Thanks, doc in training. But she gave me a printout. It was a Xerox copy of the third chapter of this book called Self-Compassion, and I was like, it was hard to get myself to read it because I've read plenty of self-help books before, and they're pretty much all trash. Like, if they had an actual answer that worked for everybody, then I think we'd all know about it.
Yeah.
In general.
That's kind of.
So, I hesitated, but I got to the reading of it, and it felt different. It felt like it was very clinical, it was very academic. It was like, this is why we do what we do, this is how it works, this is how you can do it, but, the emphasis was always on, we did tests, and we found that when people this way about them, they can do this. So, let's talk about the book itself. It's just titled Self-Compassion. It came out in 2011. It was written by Dr. Kristen Neff, who works at the University of Texas at Austin. She specializes in ed psych, educational psychology, that is, especially the field of self-compassion. She's sort of the pioneering researcher. The book breaks down, here's why you would want to be compassionate to yourself. Here's the core components of that compassion. Here's the benefits, how it relates to other people, and the last couple of chapters are about the joys of being able to be self-compassionate. And the beauty is that at its heart, it's not really a self-help book. Like I said, it's very academic in its presentation, but it's also very gentle. She'll explain a whole series of clinical trials and what it proves, and then very gently go, so this thing happened to me, and I wasn't very self-compassionate, and probably you can understand, some parallels in your own life. I started doing this, and it helped me do this. Would you like to try it? Here's some examples. Or, here's some exercises. So it's more like a clinical psychologist reaching out to you through a book than, somebody trying to sell you on, this is a philosophy that's going to change your life.
Yeah.
It never really pushes or pulls you. It understands the journey is your own to take. This book has been really well received. I checked out Amazon. There's 388 reviews. 306 of those reviews are 5-star reviews. And 90% are either 4- or 5-star reviews. I checked out a couple other well-known self-help books on Amazon just to see what ratings are like, and nothing actually clears a 75% for that 4- and 5-star rating. So this one is, it's different. And I can testify, I went from true self-hatred. I'm not trying to get overly sentimental, but there were multiple times in my life that I have attempted suicide because I thought the world would be a better place if I wasn't alive in it anymore. I'm not quite at self-compassion yet, I'm still working on it, but I'm at least to self-acceptance, and that book got me there in the space of about a year and a half. Really closer to a year, if I'm honest with how diligent I was about reading. So I can genuinely say it changed my life. Here's my simple sell. You know that feeling that you have where you feel like you can't stand yourself, and you're just frustrated because your brain keeps telling you that it's bullshit, and you're trapped, you're stuck in that. This book can make that shit practically disappear, assuming that you take it seriously. It's still gonna be there. You can't really make that voice disappear, but it will shrink it down to the point that it doesn't threaten you anymore. And the reason that I'm using this for Got Too Late, this is something I could have desperately used when I was a teenager. It wasn't published at that point, but if I had picked it up in 2011 when it came out, I like to think that I'd be a lot further in my life right now. if you're someone who's struggled with mental health or even just being generally happy on your own, try the book out. If you don't like it, you can yell at me. I won't mind.
I don't have
follow that. That was intense.
Yeah, I apologize if it was too intense.
No, definitely not too intense. Like, it sounds really good. I kind of want to read it now, actually.
I have a copy sitting here if you want to borrow.
I might take you up on that. Like, I have so many books to read, but that sounds like a useful one. And that's kind of where I'm at. I think, like, after I finish the book that I'm reading, I think the next one I'm going to pick up is What We Owe to Each Other.
Oh, yeah.
Which I bought because of The Good Place, which, if you haven't watched that, you should.
Watch The Good Place! Both seasons! Both of them!
Right. Like, they do such an amazing job of redefining parameters for the second season, and then again for the presumptive third season. Goddamn.
I want to be on the wall in that writer's room.
Oh my god, yes.
Just to hear, like, how conceptual they actually get. Because I'm sure they have to rein it in.
Speaking of reining it in,
yes.
My third thing is kind of silly. But so, with, like, the first two things, I thought about, like, okay, I have a negative attachment based on time. The second thing was, like, I don't have a positive attachment based on time. So, I thought, like, okay, for, like, a third thing, what's something that I don't have any relationship with because of time? Mm-hmm. Like, what's something that I don't understand because I missed it? And so, thinking about it that way, I wanted to do something, like, really old,
mm-hmm.
because, especially to the recent history, like, we live in a time where our ability and effectiveness in mining the past is better than it has ever been. And, like, that's something culture has always done. It's always referred to itself, but, like, we've never retained information like we do now, so, like, it's hard to find something that, like, you were born too late for, because you can still go to a disco. There are swing dance clubs. Like, whatever you're into, somebody probably wants to do it with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I tried to think of something that wasn't something you could still just kind of go out and do, or go out and, you know, get, or is, like, part of the culture. And I don't know if this exactly qualifies, because I know about it because, like, a series of articles, and I use that term very loosely, kind of made their way into the content feed over a couple of years. So it's something that'll, like, pop up on Facebook every now and again. It's like, hey, this thing. And I'm talking about medieval knights and snails.
Wait, what?
So, there's this thing, and I'm basing this on a couple of, like, articles that came up with a Google search. There was a video produced by Vox that's, like, a little 2-minute, you know, content feed sort of thing about this. There's an article on Smithsonian.com entitled Why Were Medieval Knights Always Fighting Snails? From October 14th, 2013.
Yes, now I know what you're talking about.
And basically the deal is, in a series of illuminated manuscripts, I think one thing, like, cites over 70 different examples, that occurred between, like, right at the end of the 15th century and the beginning of the 14th century, like 1290 to 1320, some in that kind of general area. Like, this artistic motif came up where, like, in the illuminations, there would be a depiction of a knight doing battle with a giant snail. And, like, there's enough of these things, and, like, enough different people clearly did it, and, like, in different regions, that, like, this was a thing. This was the meme of its day. But nobody's really 100% sure what the hell it's about.
Does a knight who's fighting a snail wear snail mail armor?
I'm taking off my glasses.
Yeah, he's massaging the bridge of the nose.
I love it though. Okay. So, the Smithsonian article that I'm kind of, like, basing some of this on cited a couple of examples that I just want to mention because, like, the format heretofore has been about specific works. So it's like, here's a couple of specific works. And one is something called Queen Mary Psalter, circa 1310 to 1320. And something called Brunetto Latini's Les Livres du Tresor, I don't speak French, circa 1315 to 1325. And I don't really know what either of those things are, but I do know that Brunetto Latini was the guy who, like, adopted Dante after his dad died.
Hmm.
So that's something. Like, he was a philosopher or something like that. Anyway, so there are a couple of theories about what this ancient meme might mean. Sort of the leading ones that I came across were a lot of people thought, like, perhaps it might be a reference to death, because there is a verse, Psalm 58:8, which reads in part in the King James Version, "As a snail which melteth, let every one of them pass away." So, like, maybe it was somebody kind of riffing on that and being like, snails mean death now. Deal with it. but sort of that's like maybe like the second most common theory that I found when I tried to look for something. The most common theory comes from possibly the first scholarly article on the subject, which was written by a woman named Lillian Randall in 1962, entitled "The Snail in Gothic Marginal Warfare," which is a great title.
It really is.
And basically what it went to is there was this Germanic tribe in, like, northern Italy, I think, called the Lombards, that through a series of historical circumstances developed a reputation as kind of a slimy people, and so that this depiction of snails was associated with them as, like, basically a racial slur.
Right.
And, like, that's an explanation that makes sense. Like, that seems like the most credible thing that I've come across, certainly. But there are lots of other theories or guesses as well. Like, nobody's really 100% certain. And, like, that in and of itself is interesting to me. That, like, there can be something... 'Cause, like, okay. I'm gonna get into, like, the abstract shit again here for a second.
Please do.
But, like, those two examples that I talked about were, like, kind of singular experiences, where it's, like, about my personal relationship with something, whereas something like a meme is broader than that. Like, it's not necessarily about a single interaction with a piece of media. Like, it's about a confluence of interactions where, like, multiple media get mixed in together with multiple different people's perspectives. And, like, it's something that is experienced on kind of a broader, more cultural level. And, like, I'm going to read again because I like this phrasing. "Its meaning is so encoded in the context of that particular moment in time that it can't be fully understood outside it." I mean, it's like, even, you know, starting on, like, tumbling and, like, looking at memes from, like, 2015, it's like, what?
Yeah.
What does this mean? Why was this funny? I remember thinking it was, but what? So, like, that's an interesting kind of, like, it muddies the waters a little bit, I guess,
mm-hmm.
because it's, your relationship with art is fundamentally more than only your personal relationship to it. It does exist in a context, and there is a broader connectivity to it. And that's a concept that I find really fascinating, and that I want to talk about more, but not now.
I love the conceptualization of giant snails fighting knights as a meme, because it's, one, the sort of thing that you would see as a meme, and it wouldn't really be that, like, it wouldn't faze you. You'd be like, yeah, of course. But it also implies that there's, like, a certain level of, like, shitposting that could have existed in medieval times.
Which there definitely was.
Painters would go out of their way to spend, like, weeks on a shitpost. And everyone would be like, it's a fucking snail fighting a knight. That's hilarious.
Well, I and then move on. Of, like, Chaucer's apology to the Canterbury Tales, which is one of the most sarcastic things I've ever read, and it's great.
This is true.
Anybody not familiar, it's like Chaucer basically being like, oh, I'm super sorry if this offends you, like, uptight churchy people, because you are so moral and I'm just terrible. But in, you know, flowery Middle English.
Of course. Yeah, no, it's interesting. I'd read a couple of things about these snails. When you first brought it up, it made me think of House of Leaves, a book that I used for the What Do You Like But Cannot Recommend to People. the whole, like, last third of the book, there's this repeated reference to a snail shell and how it's always constantly heading towards the center, but the physics of, like, getting smaller as you grow closer to a central point, and, like, does up remain up as you continue climbing through a spiral?
Yeah.
And all of these questions
like
that.
It's, like, crazy dissociated is the word that comes to mind.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it's anchored in any kind of reality anymore. Still concrete enough.
Yeah, it still has meaning somehow without yeah. really making reference to anything, which is an odd mechanism and, like, one of the things that's really cool about it.
Yeah. What an odd book. Not that that's the point right now, but...
it's a point.
Yeah. Snails and knights here on Does It Matter?
Next time, what did we talk about? We talked about something outside. Oh, surprises. Like,
yeah,
when you didn't get what you were expecting.
Yes. I'm going to write that down, because I am bound to forget. Surprises.
That'll be an interesting one.
It almost, by definition, has to be.
That's true. Okay.
So I guess it leaves us with weekly what's new recommendations?
Yeah, I have one.
I gotta think for a minute, so please kick it off.
Okay. So I reached the peak of a personal Everest recently.
Oh my.
And to lead into that, I want to talk about the most expensive DVD I've ever bought. And you've seen my office. I have a few.
Just a select couple.
Yeah, you know, a small collection.
Covers an entire wall of a very respectable sized room.
There's about 1,500. I went to film school. It's what I do. Well, it's not what I do, but it's what I love. So, the most expensive DVD I ever bought was when I was in college and I was working and I had what, from my current perspective, does not amount to extra money, but at the time was money that I did not need for anything specific and hence I could spend. And so I went down to the 16th Street Mall in Denver and wandered into the Virgin Megastore and was like, I'm just gonna get something ludicrous. I don't know what. And I walked out with a Criterion Collection DVD that, a DVD box thing, that was about $120.
Oof.
And what it is Rainer Werner Fassbinder's Berlin Alexander Platz.
I'm making the motion of that going right over my head.
So Fassbinder was a, like, German New Wave, New German Cinema director, active from, like, the late 60s until his death in 1982. During that roughly 15-year period, he made more than 40 movies.
Hot damn.
Produced or put up or directed or whatever, like, 24 plays. Did a bunch of TV shit. Like, this was a prolific motherfucker. And his movies are odd. Like, he started in the avant-garde and then kind of moved into, like, weird social dramas, often with, like, strange emphases on, like, both German identity and, like, sexuality and perversion and, like, social mores and the intricacies of relationships. Like, that's his fucking wheelhouse. So, in 1980, I believe, he adapted a 1929 kind of avant-garde expressionist Weimar novel called Berlin-Alexanderplatz into what is referred to in the opening title card as a film in 13 parts with an epilogue. The listed running time on the back of it is 980 minutes, which translates to just a little bit shy of 16 hours. So I bought this, and I was like, cool, I'm gonna do it. That's a lot. I'm gonna do it later. And like, only 10 years went by.
As it does.
So, this past weekend, Kat was out of town, and I did not feel super great. I was a little under the weather. I did not feel like moving a whole lot. So I was like, alright, I've seen some other Fassbender at this point. I kind of know what I'm in for. Let's fucking do this thing. And I watched it in 3 days.
Oof.
It's amazing. It's a lot.
You don't say.
Like, the whole thing is, like, soaked in this kind of, like, orangey sepia tone. Like, not in, like, a film stock kind of way, in, like, a production design kind of way. Like, there's long passages, like, no dialogue, or, like, a character will take, like, an absurdly long time reacting to something. Like, it's stretching out all of these moments. Like, it's not just that it itself is really fucking long. Its relationship to time is such that it is very long. Like, it's very slow. But it is fascinating. And even though it may not have sounded like it, I would recommend it.
Sometimes the ones that give us, like, the most harrowing experience in the viewing of,
yeah,
the ones that's like, I know it sounds like I'm describing some sort of PTSD, but seriously, watch it.
Yeah, and harrowing is, like, not a totally inappropriate word for it. It's largely about suffering. As a quick side note, the episode titles, like the, like, film that, well, no, I'm going to call them episode titles, that makes the most sense, are really interesting. My favorite one is episode 4, A Handful of People in the Depths of Silence.
Ooh.
But there's also, like, The Inside and the Outside, The Secret and the Fear of the Secret, or something like that.
Hmm.
Like, they're really very flowery and ornate and interesting.
I like that. Especially since, like, I'm sure you've noticed, like, when I write songs, they're always, like, I just took the word that I think is used the most often in this song. That's the title.
I mean, that makes more sense than some song titling theories that I've heard. There's a famous, like, Billy Corgan quote where he's like, I forget how it starts, but it's something that's like, you write a song about I don't know how it starts, but like it's this chain of things. God, I totally botched that. I'm going to look up that quote, and that's going to be on things I should have remembered next time. Anyway, I'm rambling at this point.
Let's see. Stuff that I would recommend this week. I've seen a couple movies that I'm not going to say I recommend. I've seen a whole bunch of a TV show I would, but we're not there yet.
Yeah,
because
I'm watching it too. We're going to do a thing, probably, I guess.
Yeah, I think we'll probably end up doing like a joint talking about it at some point with a theme that suits it well. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to reach back. This is a stand-up special that I've seen 3 times now. Most recently, my mom. And generally, if my mom gives a comedy special a seal of approval, and so do I, that means everybody's going to like it. it's called Stand Up for Drummers. It's by a fella named Fred Armisen. You might know him from Portlandia.
Which just ended.
Basically, the premise of this stand-up special, and yes, it has a premise, is you're only allowed in if you can prove that you are an adequately talented drummer using the sticks and pad at the entrance. And I believe you actually have to bring your own sticks to even be admitted. Like, they made it a little bit elaborate. So he does, I'd say, 20 minutes of material about the music industry and, like, being a musician, like, different types of music. He has about 20 minutes of just, like, bizarre stand-up. And he goes over a map of the United States and does the accent for each region of the United States, state by state. It's incredibly impressive, and just for fun, sometimes he'll bounce between, like, 4 of them in the space of, like, 3 seconds. And then the last 20 minutes, he does this, like, ode to John Waters, followed by he plays 10 different drum kits, each from a different decade of the history of the United States in terms of music. He, like, shows you what the kits looked like as time developed them, and then plays them in the style of that decade. It's one of the most fascinating stand-up specials I've ever seen.
Yeah.
It's incredibly broad, obviously, but it...
Still very high concept.
Yes, very high concept. He has a tendency, Mr. Armisen, to give the premise of a joke and then just leave you with the premise and then move on to the next premise of a joke. Like, you can see where the punchline is going, and he just kind of, like, leaves you there with it. There's no point in him finishing it for you. It's incredibly entertaining. Entertaining is the right word for it. So check out Stand Up for Drummers. It's available on Netflix. That seems like it does it for this week.
Yeah, that's Ben's petting a cat on his lap like a supervillain.
He's digging his claws ever further into my kneecap.
Yeah, he's kind of giving me a look like a supervillain.
His favorite pastime, because he is a supervillain. His name is George, but I like to call him all variations on that, like King George, Giorgio, Mr. Armani, Jorge occasionally. Yeah, so that's our cat epilogue. Thanks for listening.
Now with cats.